Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's April 21st, 2015 8th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 8, Deferred Compensation for Hedge Fund Managers. Richard Zarin, Gene Cogill, and Craig Bittman will discuss deferred compensation for hedge fund managers. Part 8, Use of Options and Stock-Settled Stock Appreciation Rights to Compensate Investment Managers. Now, on to the podcast.
We're going to talk today on deferred compensation for hedge fund managers and some new techniques that might be available to hedge fund managers. And I guess what we probably could have called this session is deferred compensation, what was, what is, and what we wish it would be. So I'll start out. I'm Craig Bittman. I'm a partner in the Employee Benefits and Executive Compensation Practice in New York. To my left is Jeannie Cogill, who is also a partner in the New York Employee Benefits and Exec Comp Practice. And Rich Zarin is a partner in the tax group here also in New York. Why don't we start off with kind of a historic discussion of what deferred comp looked like for hedge fund managers. I think many of you are probably aware of the practice that had grown up in the 2000s, where a lot of people deemed it to be the super 401k, where you had hedge fund managers that were able to defer their annual management fees and or incentive fees that they earned each year, take the amount that was crystallized in that year, and make an election in advance of the service period to defer that amount into a future payment date. The amount was then paid out at whatever the elected time period by the manager, and it was usually indexed off of the return on the underlying hedge fund. The fund itself would then usually make that matching investment into its own fund. The employees of the hedge fund manager were then also often given the opportunity to make an election like this. So then you had effectively a back-to-back arrangement whereby employees and or principals of the hedge fund manager would make an election saying, take my compensation that otherwise would be due, be it in incentive compensation, bonus, or otherwise, and defer it. And then the manager itself that was going to pay that compensation would make a back-to-back deferral election to the actual underlying hedge fund. Well, 409A came along, and 409A came around in the wake of Enron, and it affects deferred compensation of all types of entities. And that put some restrictions on the use of deferred compensation for all employees, but it didn't make it impossible for hedge funds to continue to that offshore super 401k deferral. But it just placed some restrictions on when the elections could be made and on the timing of those elections and when the amounts could be paid out. Well, along comes 2008, and there's an uproar about the hedge fund managers having supersized offshore 401ks, and Congress passed Section 457A. And what 457A was intended to do was to effectively eliminate this concept of the offshore 401k for hedge fund managers. And so what it says is that effectively, with very limited exceptions, these offshore deferrals will not work anymore. And the reason why they won't work is because the only way that you could continue to defer money is when the amount is not vested. And for these purposes, vested actually meant continued service. So effectively what that means is that for the offshore hedge fund, the deferral will not work so long as the manager does not have to perform services, then that's deemed vested and it's immediately taxable. There's one limited exception to that where if you want to allow up to 12 months of deferral, that's acceptable. An important aspect of this also is that even if the amount of the deferred compensation can't be determined, that doesn't make a difference. So even if you have, for instance, a side pocket investment or an investment that's hard to value, just because you can't value it doesn't mean it's not taxable. So instead, when you can ultimately determine what that value is, at that point it will be taxable plus interest plus the 20% excise tax. So it is a pretty draconian statute. So what have managers done in the wake of this? Well, there's not a whole lot that could be done. Some managers have utilized the 12-month deferral. Some have just gotten rid of the deferral entirely. some with respect to side pocket investments and other private equity type investments have gone over and switched to a carried interest model, and that generally will work for long-term investments. But again, it's fundamentally different than what it was in the early 2000s, and this whole concept of the super 401k unfortunately has fallen away. But then I'll turn over to Jeannie, who will talk a little bit about current state of play.
Okay, so as Craig explained, the bottom line with 457A is that anything that is considered to be deferred comp is going to be taxed at vesting, and vesting is when there are no more services, significant services to be provided. And Section 457A goes a little further than that, and it says non-qualified deferred comp that's going to be taxed at vesting includes any arrangement for which the compensation is based on the increase of the value of a specified number of equity units of the service recipient. Translation, stock options, and stock appreciation rights over the stock of the service recipient will be deferred compensation. A stock appreciation right, of course, is a little bit like an option, but it's like a net settled option. You don't have to actually come up with a purchase price. What you get is the increase in the value of a specified number of shares of the service recipient. You can get them in cash or in stock. So under the very words of Section 457A, options and stock settled SARs and cash settled SARs are all deferred comp. However, in 2009, just shortly after 457A was passed, the IRS came out with a very helpful notice, 2009-8, that says, wait a moment, fair market value options, that is options with a strike price, an exercise price, at or above the fair market value of the service recipient, they won't be subject to 457A. You can still have those. And the notice also said, and stock appreciation rights that must by their terms be settled in stock, that is not in cash, but be settled in stock, they too are going to be exempt from 457A as long as the reference price, that is the sort of the notional strike price, is at or above the fair market value of the stock of the service recipient. So this sort of gave us a little bit of wiggle room, but people were very skeptical in 2009 as to how far this went. For example, you know, if you have a hedge fund manager with an offshore fund and, you know, wanting to sort of reproduce sort of those massive 401ks, the manager isn't going to want to actually come up with the purchase price for an option. So, you know, the alternative is a net settled option or a stock settled stock appreciation right. But if you have a stock settled stock appreciation right, the manager is going to have this stock for some time. There may be PFIC issues. So how soon can the manager turn that stock into cash? People were uncertain, so people sort of stayed away from this approach. And then in 2014 came a revenue ruling, which really seems to have reassured people that you can, in fact, use this sort of quasi-deferral mechanism, the stock option or the stock settled SAR. Revenue ruling 2014-18 took a situation that looked very, very much like an offshore hedge fund fee deferral translated into an option, sort of an option situation. So in 2014-18, there was a service provider, it's LLC, an offshore corporation like a Cayman corporation, like an offshore hedge fund, and the LLC, the manager of the hedge fund, was given a stock right, an option, and a stock settled SAR over the shares of the offshore corporation, the hedge fund, with the strike price at fair market value. And interestingly, Rev ruling 2014-18 said that manager, that service provider, had the same redemption rights for cash as any other shareholder in the corporation. So essentially, you can give a manager a stock option or stock settled stock appreciation right over the stock of the hedge fund and give him the same exit rights, the same redemption rights, say quarterly, as any other investor in the fund, which is extremely helpful. And the ruling concluded by saying that's totally fine. These options, these stock settled SARs are not subject to 457A. So we haven't yet seen a paradigm shift in people actually putting this into play, but one thing that could actually work, subject to PFIC issues, something that could actually work here is structuring multi-year incentive compensation to take advantage of the option or stock settled SAR approach of Rev Ruling 2014-18. So section, before the Rev Ruling, people thought that if you did a multi-year fee, you would run into 457A problems, and I think you would. You know, say for example, you had a three-year multi-year fee starting at the beginning of 2016 that ran for 3 years, 2016, 17, 18. If you took the increase in the value of the offshore fund between 2016 and 2018 and then gave a fee at the end of that three-year period, that fee would not be determinable until the end of 2018. And because 457A says if something is not determinable at the time it's vested, it gets taxed when determinable plus a 20% additional tax plus interest, that obviously made this an approach that really was not very helpful to the manager. So what it seems that you can probably do now, subject to the PFIC issues that Rich is going to talk about, is possibly take a fair market value stock option, fair market value stock settled, stock appreciation right, and get yourself essentially a three-year multi-year fee or a greater multi-year fee that way. And you know, essentially what that does is align the interests of the investors a little more closely than, you know, an annual incentive fee where the manager gets, you know, a crystallized fee every year. Just to give a very small example, say you have an investor investing $100 in an offshore hedge fund, and the manager has a 20% sort of carry incentive fee. If the $100 increases 100% in year one, the manager, of course, will get the equivalent of $20. If that is crystallized and taken away and the fund doubles in value the next year, the manager is going to get another $36. So at the end of 2 years, the manager would have received $20 plus $36, that's $56. If the fund then goes down at the end of the second year, between the end of the second year and the end of the third year, and the manager gets nothing, the manager still has taken away its crystallized fee. But if you have a multi-year fee over that period and the fund doubles in value between the beginning of the first year and the beginning of the second year, again doubles in value in the second year, so we go from 100 to 200, 200 to 400, and then down from 400 to 200 in the last year, the manager is going to end up with just a $20 increase in the value through using the stock appreciation right or the stock option. So that's something that is possible. There are other techniques that could be used. If indeed the manager is given an additional optional stock appreciation right over the value, the increase in value of the fund at the beginning of year one and the same at the end of year two, you can sort of get to the same position as you would have using the sort of the 401k plan, the giant 401k plan. Anyway, in the last few minutes, I'm going to turn this over to Rich, who's going to talk about the PFIC issues.
Sure. And there's a couple other thoughts to put in there as well. But on the PFIC side, or passive foreign investment company, this whole arrangement we're talking about only applies when we're dealing with the offshore feeder of a master feeder structure or an offshore company that's an investment fund that is something treated as a non-U.S. corporation. Non-U.S. corporation that has predominantly passive investment assets in it will fit within the definition of a PFIC, which can have a variety of adverse effects for a U.S. taxpayer, such as a manager. The core piece to have in mind is that there's very little clear guidance on the proper treatment of options or other rights to acquire stock in the future in a PFIC. The regulations, such as they stand, say that that's to be treated just like an ownership of shares in the PFIC. It starts the holding period for various unfavorable tax regimes that apply unless you make special elections, such as a qualified electing fund or QEF election, and that a QEF election is not available if you hold an option in a PFIC. Digging through all of that, what that really boils down to is that, at least based on the current available guidance, if a manager is using the option approach that's being described, you should understand that there is a significant possibility that on exercising the option, you would have ordinary compensation income using general U.S. income tax principles for a compensatory option. but you wouldn't trigger the PFIC recognition moments. Later on, when you then take the resulting shares and have them redeemed or sell them, you might well have an interest charge and some additional ordinary income tax to pay as well, somewhat, especially as interest rates, if they go back up again, canceling out the tax benefit of the deferral and not having paid tax along the way. There also is at least a risk that you won't get full credit or credit for your prior income recognized in terms of basis in your shares. So there are significant uncertainties and potential hazards given the PFIC rules and their lack of their guidance. I think the important other thing to have in mind here is to compare the option alternative, which is something people have been talking about now with some particular parties in the market for 5 years or more, to the other path that's come up a lot, which is, well, to align the economics of investors, use, let's say, a rolling 3-year profit interest approach. The advantage of the option approach is that you don't end up having the manager allocated taxable income each year on its accruing share of the carry it might get in 3 years if the gains hold up, and needing from the investor's point of view, cash out a tax distribution, reducing the amount of money at work to pay those taxes. But otherwise, the fact is the profit interest approach tends to give you a fairly predictable tax treatment, at least under current law, in terms of the ability to align the manager and the investors better. A concern, at least, that I personally continue to have with these arrangements and on the option or SAR side, and I think this is reflected by the fact that really nobody's pulled the trigger on one of these arrangements yet, is that if you add more bells and whistles, as was mentioned, you get closer to the same sort of deferred compensation, offshore IRA or 401k plan flavor that led to front page articles in the Wall Street Journal. And that I think if somebody particularly does this in a way that pushes things that way, that it would be easy enough to see a reaction back from Congress or the IRS. Rulings, revenue rulings can be changed. They do not actually ultimately bind the government. They also only cover particular facts. And I think that there is a variety of both tax and reputational risk to be quite careful of, as especially moving toward aggressive versions of these structures.
For those of you who might be managing plan assets from the ERISA perspective, I know you probably know that there was a big release last week by the Department of Labor of a new fiduciary rule. Jeannie and I are happy to talk with you about that, so thank you very much.
To listen to other panels from the 2015 8th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.